yearning for the world, Switzerland and the sea. It's said that all rivers flow to the sea. If that's the case, then Switzerland, source of the Rhine, the Rhone, and many other rivers, must be one of the greatest wellsprings. And yet the country lies at a considerable distance from the world's oceans. The sea has inspired writers and explorers, stimulated tourism, and incited engineers to develop adventurous ideas. Max Frisch and the Sea. In March 1946, Max Frisch spent an hour at the Baselminster and gazed down at the Rhine, which flowed over the German and French borders, just a few hundred meters downstream. "How small our country is," he commented in awe. The Second World War had ended a few months before, and the writer expressed sentiments which moved many in Europe at that time. Our longing for the world, our desire for big flat horizons, for masts and jetties, for grass-covered dunes, for reflecting canals, for clouds over an open sea. Our desire for water binding us to all the coasts of this earth. Our nostalgia for foreign lands. Max Frisch, who was born in Zurich in 1911, felt impelled to leave his home country early on as a young man. In 1933, he journeyed to Prague as a journalist with the Neue Zürcher Zeitung newspaper. His original intention had been to report on the ice hockey world championships before returning home. However, Frisch carried on traveling to Budapest, Belgrade, Sarajevo, Dubrovnik, Istanbul, and Greece. Arrived in Split after a 9-hour sea passage of staggering beauty, he wrote to his mother. Newspaper readers were treated to descriptions of impressions which overwhelmed him with their abundance and allure. "Actually, these Dalmatian days proved utterly exasperating," he wrote in the NZZ on the 27th of June 1933. The reason of his despair, that one cannot paint and is obliged to leave such extraordinary colors behind. Yet Max Frisch tried his hand at painting nonetheless. His painting Ragusa, as Dubrovnik was once known, shows that creative talent lay dormant in the young writer, who would embark on a study of architecture at ETH Zurich just a few years later. He incorporated his experiences in Dubrovnik into his first novel, Jürg Reinhardt, in 1934. Max Frisch maintained an intimate relationship with the sea and with water until the end of his life. Perhaps it's no coincidence that Frisch's most important architectonic legacy is an open-air swimming pool. His Letzigraben outdoor pool, which opened in 1949, features a modern sports pool nestling amongst swathes of organic parkland. Located in the middle of the city, the sparkling water continues to radiate holiday feeling. The characters in Frisch's novels and stories also embark on sea voyages. Engineer Walter Faber, for instance, the protagonist of the novel Homo Faber, travels by ship from New York to France, returning with this from a highly technical New World to an archaic, mystical Europe. In a video interview, literary scholar Beatrice von Mutt describes the significance of the sea in the life and works of Max Frisch. Private, previously unpublished film footage of the author is also shown.
The sea was the most intense force of nature that Max Frisch ever experienced. It was also a wide open expanse for him in particular, having grown up in a landlocked region. In this context, I find a statement from Frisch's later years particularly significant, in which he remembers being an active duty soldier in Ticino. At the time, the invasion of the German armed forces was an impending threat. The year was 1940. Frisch thought, "I shall either survive or not survive. It would be a pity not to see the sea again. Not a book or a woman, but the sea." The sea plays a conspicuous central part in many of his works. Beginning with the very first novel, Jürg Reinhardt, published in 1934. This partially autobiographical tale is set on the Adriatic as well, and features as a recurring theme the term blue of the giant seashell. With this blue of the giant seashell, he describes the faraway merging of the sky and the sea on the horizon, creating a space of transcendence. Of course, the sea is also a principal player in the novel Homo Faber. However, its mise-en-scène is quite different here. The technologist Faber reaches the sea almost by chance. The sea in Montauk, a work of radical self-interrogation and self-justification, is vastly different. The sea had to be included even here, almost as an entity to which he must prove the worth of his life story, recapitulated in this work, which he fails to do in the end. The sea reappears in a very late short piece. Here, Frisch describes sketching an idea for a house while sitting at a bar in New York. This, he writes, is his Lebensabendhaus, the house of his sunset years. His dead friends will visit, as well as Chekhov and Tolstoy. His loved ones come by just for a day, and then they leave again. He sits all alone in the house, which might be at the seaside.
A geologist on the Mediterranean. Just a few years after Max Frisch's journey through Southeast Europe, geologist Leo Verli began giving lectures at the Adult Education Center in Zurich, Volkshochschule Zurich. During the 1936-37 winter term, Verli, one of the college's founders, lectured on the topic of European and North African seaports, as well as on the geological character of the seabed. Verli knew what he was talking about. As a pupil of Albert Heim, the renowned professor at ETH Zurich, he was a proven expert and had visited numerous places and countries personally. Verli had traveled to Argentina, Brazil, and to Mediterranean destinations. He recorded his experiences in Greece and Tunisia on camera or on paper, in the form of sketches, subsequently illustrating his lectures with slides, which his wife Margaret colored by hand. They not only showed the coastal region's geological profiles, but also included a series of captivating beaches. It's likely that he succeeded not only in arousing scientific curiosity, but also the longing for far-flung places in some of his listeners. Mr. and Mrs. Switzerland by the Sea. Today, the sea is a tourist destination par excellence for the average Swiss holidaymaker. However, this wasn't always the case. Travelling remained the province of the nobility, pilgrims, missionaries, scholars and traders until well into the 18th century. It was, after all, expensive, time-consuming and fraught with danger. Holidays as we understand them today, in other words travel, serving the purposes of individual recreation and pleasure, is a relatively new phenomenon. In the 19th century, the railway proved essential to the development of tourism. Switzerland began work on the expansion of its rail network around 1850, relatively early when compared with European countries, although the areas which would play a crucial role in Swiss tourism, specifically the Alpine regions, were not developed until the end of the 19th century. The opening of the Gotthard Railway Tunnel in 1882 constituted a breakthrough in two key ways. Not only did it encourage and facilitate trade relations with the South, it also boosted Switzerland's tourism infrastructure. New transport links like the Gotthard and San Bernardino tunnels meant that the Italian beaches were finally within reach. Travel operators, including Zurich-based company Cuoni, founded in 1906, and the national airline Swissair, founded in 1931, would also eventually ensure that holidays in more remote countries were affordable. Swiss citizens discovered the world. And the world came to Switzerland. Migrant workers from Italy settled here and enriched the local cuisine with their dishes, with the result that some fear the Mediterraneanization of Switzerland. Max Frisch also added his tuppence worth to the social debate around immigration. A little master race feels threatened, We asked for workers. We got people instead, was his statement from 1965, which is still cited to this day. Max Frisch stood for a Switzerland which embraced democratic opening. After all, he also lived in Rome and later in Berlin and New York as well. He never stopped scrutinizing the national symbols and myths of his homeland with a critical eye. The chanting of Swiss youth on the country's streets in the 1980s would doubtless have met with his full approval. Down with the Alps, give us a clear view of the Med. The sea in Switzerland. To enjoy the magnificent spectacle which the sea presents, the inhabitant of Switzerland must undertake a long journey. The Swiss may, however, with less trouble, make himself master of ancient oceanic natural history. He resides in the midst of a vast marine bay, from which the water has flowed off and has left the land dry below it. This is an excerpt from a scientific treatise entitled The Primeval World of Switzerland, dating from 1867, which was written by the paleontologist and professor at ETH Zurich, Oswald Heer. It's difficult to imagine that Switzerland was once immersed in water, yet the sea can indeed be discovered in Switzerland, be it in the form of the Sea of Mist in the Alps, or at the countless bathing places in towns and in the countryside. Max Frisch, who once strolled through the Dolderwald forest on the Zurichberg Hill, caught a glimpse of a rectangle brimming with warm Adriatic Sea, whose bright, vividly dazzling greenish-blue surprised us and filled us with silent jubilation. A magical colour which lies there like the transparent radiance of a jewel through the trees. Here he was referring to the Dolder wave pool, and the dialect musician Kuenz sings the praises of his native Lake Lucerne in a pop song of the same name. Wer hätte behauptet, Schweiz hätte kein Meer? Who said Switzerland has no sea? Attentive walkers along Zurich's Limmat Quay are sure to notice a strange object, a bollard usually used in large ports to moor seagoing vessels. What is this bollard doing here by the river, which is used solely by the rowing club team and the municipal Limmat boats? It was originally part of an art project initiated by the Zurich Transit Maritime Group. They installed a controversial temporary port crane in 2014-15 and five bollards along the Limmat Quay. The background to the project involved an analysis of a fascinating chapter in Switzerland's commercial and technical history. In the 20th century, the Transhelvetian Canal had been planned to make the Swiss waterways navigable right up to the Alps, and even aspired to cross the mountains. Historian Andreas Teuscher tells the story of this adventurous scheme, showcasing Swiss engineering skill, in the video below. Here on the Limmat Quay in Zurich, the street features large bollards like those for mooring seagoing vessels. But there are no large seagoing vessels here. These bollards are part of an art project from 2014, when an artist collective erected a giant dockside crane, seen at the back here, on the Limmat Quay. A dockside crane on the banks of the Limmat is certainly a loopy idea for a couple of artists. Quite a few onlookers were offended by it and wondered what on earth it was doing there. According to them, it had no possible link to Zurich. However, and I was amazed when I found this out, there were actually plans drawn up for a harbour in Zurich, a large harbour for large ships, transport freighters, that were intended to travel up the Rhine and into the North Sea. Zurich wasn't the only place making plans to establish navigable waterways on a grand scale. At the beginning of the 20th century, there was practically a shipping hype, at least as far as planning was concerned. Basel was the first to build a port, and one of the pioneers of this effort was the young engineer Rudolf Gelbke, who came to Basel just after his studies at ETH to realize his shipping plans. It's due to him that Basel now has a port. One of the zaniest ideas back then was to create navigable waterways in the Alps. An engineer named Pietro Caminada wanted to navigate ships across the Alps. He planned a vast network of canals via the Splügen Pass, where transport freighters would pass through a colossal waterlock system from north to south, and vice versa. That was pretty spectacular. The discussion of shipping in Switzerland proved to be remarkably tenacious and lasted until the 1990s. I have the feeling that this has a lot to do with Switzerland's longing for the sea as a landlocked country. Swiss companies continue to operate a deep-sea fleet flying the Swiss flag today. Founded in 1941, this was created in order to guarantee that Switzerland remained supplied with imported goods during the Second World War. Landlocked countries like Switzerland were only granted the right to ocean shipping under their own flags in 1919, as part of the Treaty of Versailles. The home port for Swiss ships is Basel. If plans for a Trans-Helvetian Canal had actually been implemented, they would today be able to sail from the sea to Zurich or Geneva.